listeners, my name is Henrik Palmgren, and it is good to have you with us. We have Michael Tesarion back with us on the program today to continue our discussion on conspiracy and psychology. This is a follow-up show to our most recent one that we did on the roots of tyranny. We are going to continue expanding on a few of the ideas that we discussed in our last program, and also going to some new avenues as well, such as Walden 2 by B.F. Skinner. We're going to discuss Calvinism, behaviorism, and psychic sovereignty. We have so many points that we want to get to, so let's get this program started right away. But as you know, MichaelTesarion.com is the website for our guest today. Michael, T-S-A-R-I-O-N.com. Welcome back, Michael. Good to have you back with us so soon again.
Oh, thanks, Henrik. Nice to be on.
I'm really looking forward to expanding our discussion here today and go deeper into some of the things that we touched upon last time, but also into some of the new areas. You've been doing some really interesting research, again, not only with the conspiracy in regards to the Constitution, the Constitution con, pretty much, but we have quite a few other things that we want to tie together in here. But just at the beginning here, to tie things back to the first program we did, we have something really incredible happening in terms of development here, because you mentioned kind of a prediction, I guess, last time about conspiracy becoming mainstream pretty much. And just in the time in between these two programs that we've done, Michael, we've now seen that Jesse Ventura is going to have his own conspiracy show. It's called Conspiracy Theory. It's going to be broadcasted on something called True TV. And even as you pointed out, Michael, in that program that we talked about, Alex Jones he's not going to be directly in this show, but I know he's been giving pointers to the producers of the show, so he might not be in there directly, but this is actually happening, and it's really starting, just as we talked about last time. Isn't that interesting, Michael?
Yeah, it is interesting, and I've said it, you know, before. We even talked about it. I've said it for a while on the forum and even on Coast to Coast and privately for many years. I've seen this coming. There's been many links in this chain, you know, and I've always predicted that one of the best ways to destroy something, or to at least warp it, is to co-opt it. And basically, the establishment has no choice. They see the slipping figures of mainstream shows, which is very frightening to them. And they know they're losing control to the internet and to even cable channels and even cable access channels and podcasts and just this burgeoning research community. So they've known for a certain amount of time, and I've been tracking it. I knew where they were going, and I could see that they were thinking about what possibly to do. Hopefully it'll just disappear and go away. Then they thought they could just do debunking, you know, with these front page. All the newspapers have carried, you know, belly laughing front pages at all the conspiracy people and trying to lambast David Icke and, you know, and Alex Jones and myself and others. And of course that won't work, you know, because, you know, we're bulletproof, keep on trying, you know. So then finally they really turn around, and then they have their advisors, very, very clever people who say, look, we do what we did with everything that has been controversial. You repackage it. You know, you create a, you know, you get out your Dr. Phil, you know, and instead of Freud, you have Dr. Phil. And this is the way that the mainstream does it. The whole evangelist movement is even basically for the last 5-6 years co-opted almost entirely the sort of new age approach to life, you know. Whereas if you scroll back, you know, 20-30 years ago, I even have cassette tapes of evangelists who swear blind that changing your diet to being a vegetarian and taking a holistic approach to life and working with your relationships is all immaterial to believing in Jesus. And yet now you fast forward and suddenly all of these principles, self-help principles, New Age principles, are all been co-opted by the evangelical movement. And so this happens. This is a tendency, especially when the establishment is threatened by a countercultural fringe movement that's very, very powerful. And they know that it's not going to go away, because ultimately it deals with truth, and truth will, you know, not just disappear so easily. And even though they've infiltrated the movement, even though they've tried every other tactic, this is ultimately the essence of how they'll do it, you know, which is to basically just co-opt it and PBS it and make it very mainstream. And that, of course, has also positive ramifications, but it also needs to be looked at, you know, with certain caution.
Well, exactly, because, you know, my question is if something good actually can come out of this, because to me it seems that they are just kind of co-opting the subject matters, and from what I've seen so far in terms of Jesse Ventura being interviewed on Larry King and so forth, He has some, you know, very strange points he mentions, like, for instance, bringing back the draft and things like that, taxing war in the middle of all of this. And in some cases, it seems to me that Jesse Ventura isn't really up on the ball on actually some of these subjects. He knows a little bit about it, of course, because he's been talking about 9/11 with Alex Jones on his show. But it seems to be more that the producers are pulling the strings here. That's just my point of, you know, point of view from this time. But do you think something good can come out of this, or is it just another meaningless thing that people can be into for a while and then they forget about it when it's over and done?
No, there is very good things that can come from it. But to know that, you have to sort of, again, pull back from the canvas and adopt a different perspective. I've always spoken about how the mysteries of these things, you know, needs to be seen from multiple perspectives, and you need to walk around it like you do any work of art. And when you pull back from the picture and look at where we are in the Age of Awakening. You know, I've talked a lot about 2012 and the Age of Awakening and what kind of changes will bring in. And one of them is that, you know, whether people like it or not, they're going to have to face this alternative view so that they can make greater sense of the world. So even when the beast, so to speak, picks up the truth, it's still the truth. You know, there's an old statement that says the truth is the truth, whether it comes from the mouth of the devil or the mouth of God. So the truth is the truth. It has its own power. And therefore, even if the transmitter or the messenger is a sort of a, you know, some sort of almost a joke, you know, if the messenger is sort of, you know, a clown, in a way, the truth has its own power. And one of the better things that will come of this is that this approach can soften the blow so that a lot of the world, you know, there's 300 million people alone in America, and very few of them are into conspiracy. So this might help in some way where it softens the blow to make it sort of okay for people to then go on and surf more, to read more, to take pieces and go more. Of course, it depends on the tone. If they take a mocking tone, then, you know, it could turn people off. But at the same time, it could turn a lot of people on, and just in a longer term, make it okay for people to then dabble more, to realize that there are alternative viewpoints, and to start putting the pieces together and thinking critically about these kinds of things. The thing is that these shows, why they pick somebody like Jesse Ventura, is not because basically of the show itself. There's all these other epiphenomena that is involved. For instance, you see, it's what will happen, for instance, just even practically, is that when somebody like Ventura takes a show like this, and he's a hot ticket, and, you know, he ends up then on what? He ends up on 500 other shows as a guest, where it's now second dimension, where the other hosts are saying, hey, so Jesse, what's it like to be, you know, running your own show about conspiracy? Are you really telling us this is all real? How does it feel? Are you really into this? Can we really trust it? Can it really be true? And then he becomes the sort of people's champion to appear on dozens of radio shows and dozens of other secondary level interviews and talk shows where he gives his little slant on it, you see?
Yeah.
And of course, so it's basically to make a sort of a celebrity out of him. And then he is the sort of
spokesperson for that.
Spokesperson, exactly. And then it raises up all of these different questions and makes it easy for him to turn up on other shows and sort of be this propagandist in a way for this kind of subject matter. Another good thing is that later on, because these shows are mainstream, there's always the danger that even these shows, no matter how good or bad they are, eventually start to get a bit old and jaded, and then the ratings start to slip. And it's at that point when the desperation sets in and the ratings start to slip, when people start yawning and go, yeah, we've heard this, it's not that interesting anymore. It's at that point that they might then get even edgier and bring the David Icke's on and bring the harder core people on who really have the bigger picture. I don't think they're going to do it in the beginning. Mm. It'll be topical nonsense that will make you almost want to puke, but what will happen is, again, later on, you see, there's certain, you know, other reasons. When they have to make it a little edgier, it's at that point that then you might see a little bit more of the truth creeping in, as opposed to just totally homogenized rubbish, you know, that they is much lighter, lighter stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very positive thing. And I guess the only thing that people need to be aware of is the spin on certain of these things and how it will be spun in the mainstream media on some of these topics. But I guess for one thing, the people who aren't involved in this anyway, they're only into entertainment, and for them it wouldn't matter what it is that comes out of the tube. From my point of view, this is a little bit for the people who already are into the subject matters and are keeping an eye on it, but kind of on the fence, not really sure if it's true or not or whatever, then it might help to bring in some new people, and that's never a bad thing, you know?
No, and again, it'll be about the guests. As I said, this chump is just going to, you know, want to wear the crown for a day and get his face on a lot of other talk shows, and he becomes a sort of, you know, spokesperson and whatever. Well, you can't deny that, you know, certain guests that he has on, they're the ones to watch. And I encourage people to tape these shows and take notes when they're watching it, because exactly like you say, there will be spin. So people need to use their critical ability and, really see the sort of subtextual messages that are brought out and really note those. This is a good opportunity in a way. It's like taking a class, but you don't have to leave your home. You know, I always learn from what's on television. I don't tell people to turn the television off. I didn't tell that to the kids when I taught them about the subversive use of symbolism. I say, no, turn it on. Only look at it with critical eyes. You can learn a great deal about the world from this.
Absolutely. Okay, Michael, let's dive into some of the points here and the things that we want to discuss on this program. Why don't we go over a few points again in regards to the roots of tyranny? This is something that we began talking about last time as well, but maybe you can reiterate some of the ideas before we go into the meat of this conversation, Michael.
Sure. I mean, I think what's very important to realize is that how much personal psychology, this is what we were talking about before. I mean, it's a novel area to even link psychology, which is the study of man, you know, into the conspiracy. But I mean, it's obvious once you say it. And ultimately, you see, at the bottom line, the prime datum of everything that we're looking at is man controlling man. When you're in the conspiracy movement, what tends to happen is people are talking about some hidden elite and some globalist agenda and the Illuminati and the royals and all these people. And what that can do is it can sort of give you a false impression of what's happening. You can end up being too close to the canvas. When you pull back from the canvas and look at the thing metaphysically, you discover that there's something fascinating going on, and that is that all tyranny is man tyrannizing man. It doesn't matter if it's the queen or the pope or the black pope or whoever. What you're seeing is a strange psychological phenomena that all tyranny is about one man or a group of men tyrannizing another. There's something in the consciousness of human beings that is doing this. It doesn't matter what secondary label or level of status that they, you know, they enjoy in the world. You're seeing something that goes to the roots of consciousness. And just, again, like Thomas Paine, we mentioned in the last program, the great writer and philosopher, he said that to understand the nature and quantity and even quality of government proper for man, it is necessary to attend to his character. So in my reading of this whole dilemma, it is absolutely about that. It's absolutely about looking at man, re-understanding what man is, why he enters into these relationships, and how he, you know, how he got to be in this situation. Why does he create the societies that he does? Mm-hmm. Because the principle is very simple. Unless a human being has his own inner psychic sovereignty, it's unlikely that he's ever going to form for himself or his brethren a just society. It's just not, to me, it's not impossible. If you have this pseudo-sanity, which is what you see, if a man is malignantly, you know, narcissistic and neurotic, I mean, he's going to be completely under the control of his ego and his shadow self. And from that point on, he has a problem. And he will then project his own violence onto the world and will never experience a true relationship with other people or the world around him. It's to the inner republic that we must look, because it's the character of man that creates not only his fate, but any of the individual governments and societies that he then creates.
And also, of course, we have this idea of the master and the slave, the relationship. You mentioned this before, and that's another important point in all this as well.
That's incredibly important, because it's a relationship. Most tyrannies, most oppressions are not, as a matter of fact, done by coercing or forcing anyone. It's a lot to do with, you know, our complicity. It really is. And again, I always look at, that's not to say that government isn't an institution of violence. Tolstoy said that, you know, government is nothing but a society of men who do violence to the rest of us. And, you know, Thomas Paine went on to say that, you know, the more perfect a civilization is, the less need it has for government. But you see, when there is not that self-knowledge, when man is mutilated within, when he's, you know, sort of, when he has this facade of pseudo-sanity, it's then we have to really watch I mean, Pythagoras said it. He said that if you see something destructive or corrupt in the world, it's man-made. He said that, you know, he said that you should know that self-chosen are the woes that fall upon man. This was echoed by Sophocles and so many other great mystics. You know, Shakespeare went into it in Hamlet and into King Lear. All the great thinkers know this. The Gospel of Thomas talks about it. You know, Carl Jung spoke about it. I mean, Clement of Alexandria, the famous Christian founder, patriarch, scholar, he said that the greatest of all lessons is to know yourself. For when a man knows himself, he knows God. You know, Benjamin Franklin said, only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. As nations become corrupt and vicious, they will have more need of masters. So the person who is delinquent inside himself, who is, you know, not able to understand the nature of his own selfhood, that person will then definitely be crying out for the handrails. And then you can't blame this overclass for coming along going, okay, we'll provide it for you. We know you're destabilized. We know you're getting sick of this particular entrapment, you know, so we will open the gates and lead you here to another pasture and, you know, give you some more feed and give you some more entertainment and basically huddle you together, you know, in a place that gives you that safety and that security that you don't have inside.
We also talked about identification, of course. Any points of that that you want to go over again?
Well, the identification is a huge question and gone into it a lot in other works, in the sense that I think that the one thing that the masters are very good at is to create that identification. But what we need to understand about the nature of identification is that it's caused either by love or hate. And in psychological terms, you find that identification is often created by hate, not love. We always associate, you know, identification, you know, with our heroes and models, with adoration or with admiration and with love, you know,
yeah.
And we want to emulate. But as a matter of fact, from a psychological point of view, identification is often created through the opposite emotion. You identify with the objects of your hate, and the system knows how to co-opt that. They know how to use that very faculty. And when I talk about they, you know, again, just to reiterate, I mean, we can have links put on the interview page there, you know, with the names. It's too long and drawn out to go into who these conspirators are and, you know, the conspirators hierarchy. There's some that people already know, you know, like the Bertrand Russells and the Cecil Rhodeses, but there's a lot of institutions and organizations that maybe people don't absolutely know for sure. So, you know, we'll always make sure that we put links there and encourage people to go and study these institutions.
Yes.
There's a lot of them that they need to know about that, you know, again, these are sort of the evil's willing servants, the ones who hide behind the people's champions who are from the Frankfurt School and from the Club of the Isles, you know, and Chatham House and Mount Parolin groups and the Pan-European Union. There's all of these different organizations so that people can understand that when we're speaking about these subjects, you know, we've got the proof and we have the facts. And we're going to their works, we're going to their think tanks, their documentations, their ideologies to see how these then percolate, you know, because it's like Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, you know, Tony Blair. These people have allegiances to philosophers, to sociologists, you know, like the, you know, the John Maynard Keynes and Hayek. And they have, they're just basically instruments who are putting into play the theories and the sociological theories of control from some very interesting people who we don't actually hear about or ever really told about.
And there's new ones coming up all the time as well. We have recently exposed by Brian Gerrish, Common Purpose is not one of these, but we have so many what I would call anti-human climate change groups out there these days as well, which are working vehemently in order to enslave humanity under a world tyranny, dictatorship, pretty much. You know, so there's new mm-hmm. groups coming up all the time as well.
That's right. And never to forget that while the people's champion is leading you this way, you know, like the Pied Piper, he's doing that on purpose because he doesn't want you to know about these ideologues that are behind it. He doesn't want you to know how incredibly clever they are, both sociologically and psychologically. They have to work in the dark, you see, because they're the engineers of consent and they're the engineers of the global village. And it's important that we never find out about them or the clubs that they belong to, how old the traditions are, what kind of philosophies lie behind what we see taking place. which is one of the things. Let me give you a perfect example. Not only are they aware that man's ego is a result of ancient trauma, they're aware of that. They're also aware that there's a faculty within the ego of man that wants to create chaos. I mean, even just purely unilaterally, with your own mind, your own ego on a day-to-day basis. People, it's so close to us, we've never noticed it. Loves to troubleshoot problems. You and I had talked about this in our Outsider series in a slightly different context, you know, about how then it creates the whole guilt trip and the inauthentic life.
Yeah.
Well, these masters of the social engineers are aware of this faculty. They know deeply about the nature of the ego. One of the things about the ego is that it feels empowered and it feels of utility. It has a sense of utility by literally creating problems. We manifest it into our lives, and then the ego feels satisfied that it's remedying these problems, and it gives the ego a sense of its own self. Mm-hmm. And this is a remarkable faculty. So they don't mind then creating also chaos from the outside, because this will then reinforce the ego. It gives the ego something to do, and then you have the parliament of voices and all the sects and fringe groups and all the political parties and this whole cacophony of separatism, you see, in pluralism. This is also something that keeps person running out into the external world, makes them very outer directed, and that then is the vulnerable creature who can be swayed by the public consensus. You know, it's very much brought out in the Prisoner series by Patrick McGoohan, where you constantly see this in several of the episodes that he made, of just this cacophony of different voices and different sects and different segments and different perspectives, this pluralism. But all the time, that pluralism is in orbit around a central idea, which is to keep people in their ego and in fixing what isn't broken.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the architects and ministers of slavehood, Michael. We've talked a little bit about it here, but I think there's some more things that we can mention about this.
Yeah, I mean, you not only have the architects of... Well, first of all, you not only have the architects of control, you have the architecture of control. And we've talked about that in the DVD and in other areas. There's two phenomena there. There's the architecture itself, and then you have the architects, who are, again, the sort of the pages and the exons who run around to, you know, manifest the philosophy behind the architecture. And then you've got the ministers themselves, the ministers who know how to maintain the slavocracy, the slavehood of human beings. And I believe personally that they look at it as like an art or like a game. And what we have to realize again is that to them, they get a great deal of enjoyment out of it. But they also follow some very practical stratagems. And these are coming from the Orwellian schools, the Pavlovian schools, behaviorism. We have to actually understand these modalities. They can be studied. You know, the Pavlovian idea of behaviorism, the Orwellian experiment, the aversion therapies that are often used here. And also the indoctrination processes, you know, but we'll not see it. We'll not address it, as most people are not addressing, until you finally fundamentally understand that your allegiances are completely contrived. They're not something that you really inwardly are identifying with. That's contrived. Your own sense of self. Can you imagine that? Your own sense of selfhood is contrived. Your view of the leaders is contrived. You know, your view of the opposite sex is contrived. Your view of nature is contrived. You know, your attitude towards your religions and your God is contrived. It's not original to you. These are collect. You want to fight against, you want to fight for individualism and freedom and liberty, but you have no idea what collectivism is or how it comes about. This is the study. This is the absolute study. Mm-hmm. And just specifically there about aversion therapy, you know, you saw a whole expose of that in the movie Clockwork Orange. You know, Stanley Kubrick, and of course the book went into this. And what it basically is pairing things together. Aversion therapy always is done with animals, but it's done with human beings by pairing two things together so that you have a disagreeable reaction to something when it's paired with something that's disagreeable, like a taste or an odor, you know, what they call a stimulus. And over time, if you're constantly exposed to this, you know, don't speak against the Jews. Nazism is evil. Communism is good. Capitalism is evil, but socialism is fine. All of these different idioms that you see across the world. Diversity is wonderful. You know, the global village is a shining utopia. and primitivism is wrong, and nationhood is evil, and all of these things. How do we then buy into this? There's ways of doing this by constantly, especially through the media, associating, by pairing up things that are dissimilar, so that you slowly, through a drip feed method, come to fall into lockstep with whatever it happens to be. And visual images are used a lot in the media because, of course, what does a visual image do? It bypasses your sensor.
Yes.
All you got to have is have your eyes open, and you can't resist it. It's coming in, and you may be able to resist it the first time you've seen it, the second time, even the 10th time. But what about the 10,000th time that you've seen these things, or that you're surrounded now by your mates, who after the 20th time already are falling into lockstep, and you have now to associate with those people? This is what makes your own sense of individualism, it erodes it very, very gradually. Very, very gradually. It's outside the purview. It's like changing the habitat.
Yeah.
You may not see it. The ant is not aware of how his habitat is changed, which eventually is going to fundamentally change the way that ant operates. This is the danger. And we have to become aware of these theories, like aversion therapy, and some of these other models, the behaviorist models that are used, so that we can spot it instantly and guard ourselves against it.
Yeah. Well, there's so much policing going on, policing of each other, and just as you say, Michael, frowning on certain things, and even if it's doubting global warming or whatever it is, saying the opposite pretty much, and right away people attack you for your views, and again, it's about conformity. Everyone should conform to the same idea and the same thoughts and the same beliefs about everything, and it's just the question that arises there, of course, is why is it so difficult for people to just accept that other people might hold different points of view? It's almost like they're afraid of hearing their mates talk about this because it might actually influence them to believe a conspiracy or what have you. It sounds like, to me, it's more they're afraid of opening up the floodgates, if you will. So they stick to the government-approved version of what reality is, and then that's what they prop up, and that's the one they vote for, so to speak.
That's right, and they have manuals to show them how to do this. One of them is a book by B.F. Skinner, the famous behaviorist, called Walden 2. A lot of people know about, 1984, and what's the other famous one, Huxley's Brave New World. These, if you talk to most people, who study these matters, they will accept that those two books, they know about those. And what's that other one by Bertrand Russell? It's, again, a little bit less known.
Impact of Science on Society, I think it's called.
That's the one. And there's a few in that strain. There's a few books like that. But one of the most important books that people need to know about is this Walden 2. And that's what it's actually called. And this is a science fiction book. And its theme is this utopian community, which is brought into being with a definite policy of social engineering. And you talked about communitarianism. This is it. This is the Bible of, the communitarians. But again, you see why I bring it up is because we have to realize, like I said, it's a game for them. They're going to tell you sometimes 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years before they actually make the move to initiate a particular thing. This is what this Fabianism is all about. If you listen to G. Edward Griffin and the people who will spell out what Fabianism is about, that's what they say. It's gradual, gradual, gradual. Either they don't confront you. Imagine two armies, right?
Mm-hmm.
One army is either going to act totally incompetent and will not attack you so that you have a false concept that, we're in the strength. And as soon as you think that, you've just let your guard down. Well, that's what the enemy wanted. Another strategy is that they pretend to run in fear, so that you're lured in exactly to the crevasse, or the gully that they want you to be in. So by acting that they're on the run, which is what happened with the British government when they lost the war in America during the War of Independence, they pretended to split. They pretended to, give up. And not only did America become apathetic, but it sort of chased them. They were able to lead by proxy, in this very cunning way, where the enemy where they wanted them to go. So there's multiple ways, but the most common definition of the Fabian thing is just gradualness, just a simple gradualness. And so this book, in a way, is fascinating because of this, that like Brave New World in 1984, they were already telling us, this is magnificent, So again, nobody can turn around and say, and I want people to be really armed up with all of this, because here's the other thing that, we were talking about in the beginning, it's very important to know, is that because you're going to have now a mainstream deliverance of miscellanea relating to a conspiracy. I want people to be so armed up with the knowledge of the real conspiracy, meaning they know where the manuals are, they know the hardcore stuff, that they can absolutely see, you know, the sort of a Velveeta version of it. In the sense that, you know, I don't know if you guys know in Sweden, but Velveeta is like, you know, rubbish cheese that you just buy on a shelf.
Exactly.
The cheapest, right? So it's not Gorgonzola, you know, it's not Danish blue. It's rubbish. And if you've tasted the real Danish blue or whatever, you know, then you'll know the Velveeta that it's obviously not. So this is extremely important that people harden their understanding now of the real meat and potatoes, so that when these guys are delivering up the goods and sort of, you know, doing the Svengali on you, you know, you're not going to just go under in 10 seconds like a goon. You'll actually have some armed up with some information about what's really happening here.
So that's a very good suggestion. And again, another one of these books, Walden 2, and I just for trivia, for those who want to check into this, there's another author actually based out of Gothenburg. She was called Karin Boye. She wrote a book called Callow Cain, it's called. And everyone out there who has been watching the film Equilibrium, that this is actually the basis for that film. And some of the excerpts are from that book are incorporated into that film. And this is another one of these utopian societies that are presented to people. And in this particular case, I think it's about a drug that people take in order to actually suppress their emotions, just as we can see in you know, the film Equilibrium.
These sci-fi, the science fiction genre is filled with this. The literature genre is filled with this. These are not the only books, of course, but they're certainly the ones that are quickly available. People can go from there on to the Alvin Toffler's and all sorts of other fiction and nonfiction. Like you say, the Equilibriums.
Yeah.
I think the most important thing to remember that when we're implicating behaviorism and so on is that in Walden 2, it is basically a robotic, you know, society in which you have no cash. Everybody is allotted a certain amount of land and a certain amount of, you know, time to work on it. And it's a credit system and it's a uniform system. Basically, these utopian communities are the anthill, they're the proverbial hive, you know, the perfect community. And they're like anthills. And it's very important to understand that these leaders, these elites, actually do operate like that. The anthill is a very good example, because at the center of the anthill is the queen bee, you know, the king and the queen, whatever.
Yeah.
The sort of the central intelligence. But this royalty doesn't ever want to get its own hands dirty by doing any real work. So it always then allows these lackeys and these minions to do it for them. And they put into work these strategies, these top scientists, I mean, leaders in the field. Behaviorism ruled America for, you know, for dozens of years, and many people could say it's still there. And I know that even, like, for instance, in your country, Sweden, that one of the top Illuminati families there actually used the symbol, the logo of the ant, the Wallenstam family.
Wallenstam, and, right.
Right. You'll see this logo, and the ant is even carrying something in its, you know, in its mouth.
Yes.
In its beak. And you will see that that represents, we are the worker ants. But, you know, from the street level, these guys are the billionaires.
That is weird, isn't it? It's like they what it hints about is that they manage the money for someone else, a higher queen bee, so to speak, a higher ant in the hierarchy. And these guys that we see on the street level are just the managers of that system that we can see.
And they look mighty tough and big to us. And it's phenomenal when you really step back and go that, you know, these people have had to prove their own stripes. We've talked about this before, about how that happens. That they'll even be told, like Winston Churchill is a perfect example, and there's others, where they'll be left one minute, right the other. Then they'll be liberal, then they'll be this, then they'll be that. And people can't kind of work out why they're doing this, or why it is that a Bono will be screaming, you know, hammer and sickle one minute, and then the next minute he's on his knees in front of the queen, you know, this kind of thing. What on earth is this going on? Because it's ritual. And these guys are not just, you know, perfect in the beginning. They are going to be given these hurdles to jump and hoops to jump through, like you train a dog. And it doesn't appear to have any logic to it if your thinking is just coming from the mind of a Geldof or a Bono, and what's this guy's game. These guys are on probation. They're apprentice, right? Apprentice masons, right? Mm. They have the apprenticeship.
Mm.
And you have to go and do what you do so that they can see that you have no mind of your own. You will literally go like a prostitute to whatever they send you to do. And it's only through that elaborate process, which is played out in the world, in front of us all. And it's at that point that then you initiate, you know, you get further and further up the ladder. So there's all sort of inconsistencies that you'll see.
Yes.
It is very important to, and in fact, this Jesse Ventura is probably going to go through it himself. If he's, I believe, you know, these people are probably right in on the early stages, and they're now going to have to prove their stripes, so to speak.
Hmm.
And so this also is what goes on. But these Skinners and B.F. Watsons, behaviorists, they are the architects of the benign feudalism. The people that we're talking about, you know, have never been happy with man being as advanced as he is. That's a concession because mm-hmm. they know that the smiling depressive and the smiling slave is actually more productive than the jaded slave who hates his captivity. If you put on a few movies and some bread and circuses, you'll actually have more of a happy slave who will go around and murder your enemies for you and produce whatever is needed with a great smile on his face. You know,
yes.
More salt in the gruel and more pillows in the cell. In the prison cell, and this guy will never ask for the keys. In fact, if you let him out, he'd be shivering and he'd be running back in and hiding under the bed. He wouldn't want the freedom even if you offered it to him.
Because he doesn't know anything else either. He has never been subjected to freedom, so it might actually be a scary thing. And that's a good point that you bring that up, because you mentioned that, I think, many times before, Michael, but that idea again, that people are, in one way, they're frightened of freedom. They don't know if they were given it, they don't know what they would do with it, so to speak, you know?
That's right, and that's the aversion therapy again. By associating real independence and real freedom with alienation and loneliness and insanity, you will find that now, right up the scale, even to some very, very highly intelligent people, they're terribly neurotic. Like I'd say, that most of the people you're looking at in the world are pseudo-sane. They don't have true sanity. That's nowhere. That hasn't happened at all. And when you come to the running alongside behaviorism, but of course, it began before behaviorism, so one could say that behaviorism is an outgrowth of Calvinism, running neck and neck, pretty much until the present day, is this undercurrent of Calvinism that was strong throughout the world in the Protestant communities and very strong in your country, Sweden, and extremely strong in America. It's this Lutheran Calvinistic model, and anyone who studied John Calvin, first of all, if they've studied him, they realize he was a Jewish person, actually. John Cohen is his real name. And he was part of the Illuminati establishment. And he is more responsible for creating Protestantism than even Luther was. He did more work. And this guy was one of the most psychopathic creatures that ever has been on the face of the earth. In the Geneva, where his main center was and where he started from, that was literally the most repressive police state that you could imagine.
Hmm.
You know, where women were even, you know, forbidden to wear hats. Nobody could smile. I mean, you should just read, you know, just go into Wikipedia and or go into the net and try to, you know, look up John Calvin and Geneva under Calvinism. And then it moves west, you see, into Amsterdam and into England eventually. And when you do the homework, you'll actually find out that this guy was basically a proto-communist. All the trappings of any kind of affluence or decadent society. Man was a total sinner. The world was a hideous, horrible purgatory. There was no joy in being in the body, no joy from sexuality, no joy from looking at nature. Everything was suspect, and your only good was to slave, you know, in this sort of a collectivistic way and hope that you would, you know, then merit the compassion and forgiveness of God. And this dour, puritanical aspect was live and dangerous in America right from the very, very beginning. And it had certain reactions. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit later. In the program, you know, about it did have a reaction, and that's where the New Age comes from.
Mm-hmm.
People who bash the New Age, you know, especially this sort of canned motivational stuff that you have right now with the Anthony Robbins and The Secret and that kind of thing.
Right.
And people laugh at this and think it's horrible. Yeah, well, wait a minute. That's that in a positive way, that was a reaction to this terribly grave-like, cemetery-like dourness, you see, of the Calvinism. Like I said, and even Hegel would have agreed with this, that everything eventually creates its antithesis. Well, the antithesis to this dour, Christian, morbid, deathly cult of doom and gloom and morbidity was this hippie movement and then the so-called,
New Age.
the new age and the motivational stuff that's now a bit more sanitized with Oprah Winfrey, smile and be happy, you know, Prozac smile shit. You know, that's a reaction to this. But without even getting into that, though, and just keeping it with the behaviorist model, you'll find that this is also to be studied because these are two levels that you're not going to hear about because, again, it's too close to the canvas. It's too close to people. And these Calvinists and the behaviorists are all based on that there is no such thing as consciousness. In the sense that Calvinism is against free will. Free will is the worst thing that you can imagine. You know, even Martin Luther was saying that the most devilish person is a man in rebellion. Calvin really practicalized that. The behaviorists believe you don't have any consciousness. There is no consciousness. If you can't see it with your five senses, then it doesn't exist, and that includes thinking. That includes your own thought. Your own ideas about having a self-will is utterly meaningless. You're totally to be a mannequin of the society in which the society will show you what is what. You're just a mechanical creature.
Maybe that from then, from that ideology, Michael, we actually have gotten the scientific basis and the scientific model, which kind of replicate these ideas a little bit. Because again, if we move from Calvinism into Protestantism, a lot of this came out, you know, Central Europe area, Switzerland, Germany, and so forth, where Protestantism was implemented, so to speak. And from this, from what I've been able to tell, is that we get the scientific model pretty much, and we can now see the kind of the scientific dictatorship, if you will, coming into play. And this ties into even Geneva, of course, because this is today seen as a kind of a global city. A lot of the UN has their headquarters there, the Red Cross and things like that. So it's like it's tied to a region almost as well, Michael.
It is. Well, of course, anything in Switzerland, like the city of Sion, S-I-O-N, Geneva, these are all Templar bastions. So there's, you know, there's a tremendous tie-in there with the Masons and Templars and these organizations funding these particular scientific types. This creature, B.F. Skinner, for instance, he later went on to be one of the top men in advertising. He was one of the top advisors to the advertising agency because, again, like the Edward Bernays types, they specialized in human behavior. But it was human behavior in a Pavlovian sense in which you create aversion therapies, you create stimulus responses, you treat the individual just on a mechanical basis with that his behavior is all that matters and that can be programmed in certain ways, you know, and no understanding of the world, you see, that we have today can ever be complete without knowing about this. In fact, another person that should be mentioned is Hegel. We've mentioned him a couple of times before, but when people bash Hegel, they often do it for wrong reasons. So just to clarify, George Frederick Hegel was in favor of the state control. So mm-hmm. those who bash him for, you know, wanting sort of an Orwellian sort of control state, they're right. But where they go wrong is why he wanted that. You know, they talk and then it gets very esoteric and they merely bash him just because he happened to be into sort of, you know, occultism or mysticism and all that. They don't really get to the meat. And basically, see, and don't forget that Hegel himself was a Lutheran, by the way. Mm. He was also one of these sort of Calvinist stroke Lutheran types. And his particular philosophy is very interesting because he also believed that there was no such thing, Henrik, as the personal ego.
Mm.
And how he justified this is really fascinating. He believed that there is no personal ego, there's only a social ego. And it was to do with his philosophy and some of the debates he was having with philosophers at the time. In traditional philosophy and psychology, when you study the mind, you believe two capacities that are what are called axiomatic. Axiomatic means that it cannot be doubted. It's an absolute fact. For instance, like if you have a head in a mind, you must have a body. If there's an effect, it must have had a cause, and the effect always comes after a cause. All right, that's what's considered axiomatic. No amount of wrangling can, you know, change that. Whatever. Or like the sun is a particular color, it's always that color, you know, that kind of thing. So in psychology and philosophy, it's always known that it's axiomatic to a certain extent that the mind operates in two ways. It has perceptions of the world. It understands that there's something out there called the phenomena of the world. And it also has the ability to analyze itself. Thinking, right, can think about thought. You can be aware of how you're thinking, and maybe you can even be aware that you're wrong in certain instances. So there's a certain capacity of mind to think about thought itself. So that means that, you know, the mind has two levels of awareness. And this is what Hegel, in his philosophy, refuted. He said that, no, there's actually a third capacity of the mind, because you cannot think about your own mind without considering how you, as a person, are viewed by other people. And this is like just in a nutshell. It's more elaborate than this, but I'm just making it very brief.
Right.
He said that whenever the human mind is thinking about mind, it's thinking of mind as other people see it. In other words, your vision of yourself is entirely based on considering that other people exist. So there's your third aspect then. Hmm. You think about your own mind and you know that you exist. You know that the phenomena of the world exists, but you cannot think without having a consciousness that other people also exist in a very profound and deep way. And therefore, that was the third aspect that Hegel brought to the table. And that's perfectly right. That's why I'm saying that the philosophy there is very solid. But what does that lead to? What he basically means, and don't forget that Hegel came before the Freuds and Jungs. That's why this is very important, because this would later be reiterated much more strongly and much more sort of user-friendly language by the psychologists who would come after him. But what Hegel was saying preempted Freud. He was basically saying that you are absolutely, your thought is completely aware of other people, and that your whole sense of identity and your ego is colored by each of us. We're all doing it. So in Hegel's thought, he then went even further and said, hey, there isn't any individuality at all. All there is the social persona and the social consciousness. And that then leads to the fact that society is more important than the individual.
Right.
You see how the connection then comes
about? Right, exactly. Yep.
And this is how then the lead gets taken on. So he says that, look, man is born from man and woman. Right? You, from the moment you're born, you're in company. Every society on this face of this planet, I don't care from the savage levels onwards, they've always lived in communities. Man does not like to be alone. He's born from other human beings. He has uncles and aunts and brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers. He has extended friends. He has societies. And he looks to being in society as being a good thing. And therefore, it's only one step away, isn't it, from serving that society, serving that society is good. See how we have the Calvinism and then the behaviorism coming in?
Yeah.
And this global, what we're trying to say is, let's look at the philosophies that lead up to this global village mentality. And if you're infected by it, you're walking there, you know, conveyor belt, whether you like to admit it or not. And in Hegel's reading, was that man should be then subservient to the social hive, and anyone who appears to be or wants to be an outsider is actually deranged. In his reading of things then, if you try to be too much of an individual, an outsider, you are the one with a problem. And this is what we see today when people are having problems by trying to do that. He would have thought, you see, that, well, let's put it this way. He would have said that if you're an outsider, it's not because you really, really, really want to be individual. It's because for some reason or another, you know, you got pimples on your face, or you're too fat, or you're just a bit of a thicko, or you're, you know, dark skinned, or you're not, you know, handsome enough or eloquent enough. You're only an outsider because society hasn't accepted you on your own terms like you would be. So you're not really truly an outsider. You're more a malcontent. But given a chance, you just love to be part of that society. So this, again, is very important, too, that you have to define the outsider. Is the outsider one who really wants to break away and be individual, and he sees the reasons, and he's conscious of the things he doesn't like? Or he's actually a jaded guy or girl who just can't wait to be embraced, you know, by the collective?
That's incredible. And I wanted to ask you, Michael, because this seems, again, touch a little bit into the fact of what you talked about human beings being turned into to robots pretty much as well, because if the mentality is like a robot, it doesn't really matter what comes down the line, so to speak. But what we're seeing is the extension now even of this in one way, the scientific approach to this, and that the humans don't have any consciousness, etc. Is this transhumanist movement, which is the extension of the scientific model pretty much, where we're totally removed from all kinds of humanity, you know?
This is how it works. Because all these philosophers ultimately then looked to this. They looked to this because you have to give purpose and meaning then to those people in the social hive. Once you've given over your selfhood to the social hive, well, that social hive has to have some sort of purpose, doesn't it? The ants are doing something, you know, all the time. There's activity, activity, activity. But let's look at another incredible aspect of this. These outsiders who are then living, they're going to be in continual state of existential anxiety. And it's not healthy, authentic anxiety. It's the anxiety that's created by you. Well, it's the conflict that arises between you trying to maintain your own ideas against those of the collective, which is exactly what you see when you see anyone in this world. Say, for instance, the teenagers, you know, or anybody. They're going to be in perpetual conflict just by doing that. So what's the result? The result is the danger that people cannot live with that type of depression and that conflict, and then they give themselves over to the mass because it's just too much stress to, have that tension between your own ideas that make you an individual, which is very hard to come by. You have to go through a big wasteland experience. If you leave the collective for a while, you might rush back because it's quite, you know, bleak before you've actually found the road to the true you, you know, before you get into your dharma. It can sometimes be a period of loneliness that people don't like that, and then they rush back.
Yeah.
And then there's something even more sinister. Let's never forget the limbic and the emotional component of all of this. When man cannot be individual, because like Hegel says, it's a truism that your individuality is innately tied up with visions of other people and their visions of you and the approval rating and all of these kinds of things, then you are living, as time goes by, as history passes, you actually are constantly living with the feeling that you're not whole. You are not individual. And so then your mind starts creating this sort of fictional analog individual self. It's part of the reason why we like to watch movies with Clint Eastwood and Arnold Schwarzenegger and other sort of movies of that ilk, where you have these big guys, you know, the big projected Superman types, who then represent that feeling of he's the stranger, he's the strong individual person who thinks for himself, he's monotone, and so forth and so on.
He takes the law into his own hands and do what he wants to, you know.
And hugely, women identify with this enormously, and men do as well. But go one step further. The religions have created their Jesuses and their gods to actually be that projection, to pacify the outsider. That's what it is. That's what God and Jesus are. And that's why you read in the story of Jesus, which was very well contrived to make him appear to be a renegade within his own society, to be betrayed by one of his own, to be against the state, the police state, you know, the Romans, to be against the Sanhedrin and the Jews. So this Christ is a perfectly contrived character who represents that individuality. That's part of the reason why people believe in these gurus and glowing sort of iconic figures. And then, of course, the martyr's death, you know, the lonely road to Calvary. And then they wheel that image out every, you know, so often to make you, again, you know, it's a very powerful archetype that you identify with limbically and emotionally because you don't have that. So the system creates individuals on all sorts of levels who have this existential aura of individualism and individuality because you yourself don't have it. So there's a whole, remember you were asking earlier about identification. Well, this is hugely part of this. And so the God and the Christ is a compromise.
That's incredible because that explains quite a few things of basically why we can see this archetype, the Christ archetype, revamped in different versions in the entertainment business. Charlton Heston, the Omega Man, you know, that's a full-on Jesus story right there, you know. But we have modern examples of that, too. Even in the new 2012 movie, we have a JC character running around and saving everybody, of course. You know, but he's on the outside. He's very individual in that sense as well, you know, going against the grain. It's really fascinating. That's incredible.
And not all of them are propagandists. You do have true models of it. But on the whole, yes, a lot of the Hollywood, you know, sort of Sean Connery, Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, Bruce Willis types, this is bogus to the nth degree. And underneath that, remember, it's all Orwellian trickery. They create these pseudo-individuals. And if you really are an existentialist and you watch these films, of course, you're like laughing. You know, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah.
But here we go, you know, they do this even in the National Treasure films. It's ubiquitous. And this is, again, one of the things that people need to be aware of. And I think that that's why the establishment, because we're talking about behaviorists here, on paper, behaviorists are meant to be atheists. So why does a culture that is pretty much atheistic, materialistic, agnostic, permit religion to have so much power? It's for this reason, because if you don't have the religion, you can't have these pseudo-individualistic icons that people are going to give their allegiance to. So a religion plays an enormous part. There's many of the Orwellian types as well, you know, could care less about religion. They're not religious, but they have to go through this facade of pretending that they go to church and pretending that they are all into, you know, values and religion.
Yes.
Because they know what will happen if you pull that away. If you deconstruct religion, you're going to have a serious problem of the machinery grinding to a halt. But there's even one more interesting thing to go into here. Because, of course, by Hegel's definition that society is all good and your allegiance to it is all good, by the same definition that your ego is basically a social ego, what happens if the society that he's talking about is basically the source of evil? He may or may not have admitted this, but just for argument's sake, what happens if the Hegelian populace, the Hegelian unit of society is a corrupting influence? Then instantaneously you immediately see that there's going to be a negative effect on the consciousness of those human beings, because there's such a inviolable identification going on. They're literally one and the same thing to Hegel. Your idea of yourself, what you call the I-ness, is a social I-ness. And therefore, whatever happens in society, say something aberrant starts happening in society, you automatically are going to be infected with that in some sort of Star Trek, you know, way in which you're not even going to be aware of it, like some sort of Quatermass way in which you're literally magnetized and roped in. And so whatever society does, you are going to be affected or infected, you see, by that very pestilence. This is another huge problem here. And I'd say also that I talked about Freud coming later. Hegel's model is Freudian to a point, because the social ego, as we said, is created by society. Now, remember that this, all psychologists, this is what people like all philosophers do not talk about repression.
Okay.
Right? This is a difference between the two schools. In psychology, you hear about a fascinating capacity of the ego, which is called repression, which means that the parts that cause you pain, the parts of yourself that you don't like, anything that would cause conflict and stress, the mind has an ability to repress it into what's known as the unconscious, and so that you can have a sort of homeostasis of the ego, you know, so it can function, right?
Mm.
Okay, so then backtrack and fuse together the Freudian model of repression and the ego and Hegel, and you have something absolutely incredible. And Freud would agree, but for different reasons. If the state and if the system, the populace, is controlling your sense of identity, then isn't it going to be the force that demands what it is that you repress about yourself?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because again, in the psychological model, you are basically the one who sort of decides, right? But if you tie in the Hegelian aspect, no, it's everyone that you've met, everyone that has an influence of your life, including the people in the world, the whole matrix out there, the whole human collectivism is the very thing that is policing people to repress aspects of themselves so that they conform to this mechanical, technological, because the word technology means more than just machines. It's a way of thinking. And so that kind of indoctrination then causes the Freudian forms of repression. And this is extremely important to understand, because anything that is antithetical to the mores, you know, and the likes and dislikes of the society will then have to be repressed. And in Freudian terms, it's the superego that handles this. It's a part of the ego that censors and represses any undesirable content. And the reason why it's undesirable is because it causes you pain. Well, what causes people more pain than not being accepted by their fellows or feeling always like an outsider?
Yeah.
So this is a, if it turns out that the only definition of consciousness is not that you have a personal ego, but that it's purely collectivized, and the behaviorists believe this, the Calvinists in their own way believe this, because they're collective. And if the Hegelians and the global village people all believe this, then you can understand now why we're heading towards this Walden 2 situation. There is no consciousness at all.
Yeah.
There's only mechanism, machine. And any concept of selfhood that you even have is utterly subservient to the social hive, to their social conditioning. And anything about yourself that doesn't correspond or is frowned upon, you see, or doesn't gel with, is not part of the acculturated self, is going to be repressed. And the final component of this is even more fascinating, because don't forget that the Freudian perspective on the unconscious was different than Carl Jung's.
Yeah.
And it's different in this way. Freud believed that everything that is in the unconscious is put there during this individual life. It's really a pre-conscious dumpster of just this life that you've lived.
Okay, yeah.
So this is his definition. And that definition, of course, became slightly adapted or slightly modified by Carl Jung, who said, no, the unconscious is actually a reservoir that is programmed over millennia by all human beings' existences.
Right, it's
a collective unconscious, okay?
Yeah.
And still bear in mind what we've been talking about with Hegel and Freud. But you just change Freud's understanding that it's not a dumping ground of this life, it's the dumping ground of all mankind. So it's bigger. That means physically and energetically that the so-called unconscious is vast. It's a bigger thing. It has greater magnitude than the little ego that is the censoring apparatus, you know, that sort of peaks up above the water, so to speak, and up and interfaces with this world. Hmm. And then you even go further than that, and you go into other people's definitions of the unconscious, people like the Taoists, the Native American Indians, even philosophers like Martin Heidegger, and they insist that the unconscious is even yet more than that. The unconscious is the place which your true self, right? Not the persona we've been describing, not the social sense of I-ness,
yeah,
but the true self, your true selfhood, which embodies your connection to divinity, which embodies your connection to nature, when you were once upon a time in ancient times guided by nature, and nature was your guide, and you didn't have a subjective sense of self,
yeah,
in the same ludicrous way that we have today, when nature was your guide and you were in harmony with the universe. These people are even saying that that part of you that's called the unconscious is where that is. That is where your so-called spirit and soul and self and your intelligence, your higher forms of intelligence, your deeper senses, that's where that is. So if that is the case, and I personally believe that that is the case,
mm-hmm,
and that's why it's very important to open up to the unconscious in whatever way that person can manage this, then we start to see, by again flipping it over and coming back to the Hegelian paradigm, what the global village mentality is trying to do, what the religions are trying to do. They're trying to make you as outer-directed as possible. They're trying to make you as mechanical as possible. They're trying to make you as subservient to consensus trance as possible, for one reason and one reason only: to pull you further and further into your ego. And I don't even mean a healthy ego. I mean Hegel's definition of it, the public ego, the personal, the impersonal ego, or one might even say the narcissist, the malignant narcissistic ego. You see, there's all sorts of ways you can look at this.
Mm-hmm.
The non-self, whatever you want to call it. By pulling a man away from that, you are murdering true individualism. But you can't do that, Henrik, without giving something equally alluring on the outside. It doesn't
right.
work unless you have this the carrot as well.
Exactly.
And that's where your technology yeah. comes in.
This is also, I mean, never mind if human beings live multiple lives, if we're talking about reincarnation, all that stuff here, we can just view this from the point of view of the unconscious. Then their job, the globalist job, and maybe that's why the process is so slow as well, because it actually is about programming the unconscious as well. If they're trying to slowly change what a human being is, then they have to do this over a very long period of time in order for us to even change the unconscious, because it's handled through us, if you know what I mean. If we are programmed in a certain way, if all of humanity is programmed in a certain way, then maybe next generation down the line, it will be even more simple to program them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right?
Well, that's right. What greater war, I've said it till I'm blue in the face, the war on consciousness, the war on consciousness. What greater travesty, what greater mutilation, what greater act of violence can you do than separating a man from his own selfhood?
Not much.
You know, Ayn Rand, William Blake referred to, he didn't use the term unconscious for obvious reasons. He lived before Freud and Jung.
Mm.
He referred to the unconscious as imagination.
Yeah, yeah.
Not in the same way that, you know, we've used that word today. He used the word imagination as a broad term to represent this ancestral consciousness. It's not about reincarnation in that mystical way. It's about the whole content of our unconscious being all the experiences of all men and women who've lived historically.
Yes.
You know, based on the Jungian model that all experiences become concepts become ideas, and then become archetypes. But the Blakean model is even more pure than Jung, because Jung also said that the unconscious was... he also believed that the unconscious contained negative powers.
Mm.
For him, it was mostly positive, but it did contain elements, like what he called the archetypes. And he believed that the archetypes have darker sides as well that can be threatening to the ego. So you still have a certain model there in which the unconscious is seen as something kind of nasty and potentially ambiguous and ambivalent and dangerous, you know?
Mm.
This is a traditional, very traditional stance in all psychology. But if you step a little bit out of psychology and go back to the poets and the great thinkers like Rainer Maria Rilke and William Blake and many others I could mention, they look at the unconscious as entirely positive. So much so that even the so-called things that are negative in it are positive.
Mm.
And if anything is negative in it, it's because of this repressive dynamic that's going on in the conscious mind. So they have a completely holistic understanding of man's deeper selfhood, which they refer to by different terms. This has to be borne in mind. And then what you say is very true. It has to be slow, because how on earth can you stranglehold, you know, and garrote the unconscious and separate man's yeah. conscious mind from his unconscious? It takes a lot of doing.
Yeah.
But that is what society is. We do not have civilization. We only have tyranny. We do not have justice. We only have injustice. Man is the one who's creating the society. Remember we said at the beginning, man is doing this. Man is tyrannizing man.
Mm-hmm.
We forget this because it's always them. It's always the Wizard of Oz, the guy behind the mask, the guy behind the curtain. The guy behind the curtain is a man.
Yeah.
The people who are doing this are human beings. We buy into it. It's a consensus. I mean, it's a, what do we call it? It's a contract. Man is creating society. Man represses man. Man goes and murders indigenous people and calls them savages. Man is the one who's building the global village. Man is the one, you know, running and hiding from himself. Man is the one who sees nature as a demonic presence. Man is the one who wants some bogus heaven after he's dead and gone. You know, man is the one who sends children down the mines. Man is the one who murders his fellows for no reason.
But Michael, on top of that, I guess, if it's true about the archetypes, then we might look at a situation where some of these individuals who are doing this actually have come to identify with some of these more demonic forces, if you will, and actually are playing out this archetypal evil seed in the world, if you know what I mean.
Yes, that's one theory. That is a definite there's legitimacy to that. The existential psychologists, people like Otto Rank and others, and Viktor Frankl and all, they don't buy into that at all. They have since changed their ideas about the unconscious, and they believe that it is entirely man's estrangement from his unconscious and his commitment to the consensus that causes this aberration, that man is cut off from the veins and arteries that are the roots, you know, that go deeply into the soil.
Yes.
And but these psychologists are not saying anything that isn't even in the Bible. You know, the Book of Mark says it is from within, out of the mind of man, that all evil emerges.
Hmm.
Yeah. And of course, there's the rebuttal. There is the rebuttal of psychology, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of people go, yeah, well, I know my unconscious is full of garbage. Why would I want to go and dig through garbage? And my answer to that is because it's your garbage. It's part of you. Your conscious mind thinks of it as recalcitrant. It thinks of it as toxic waste. No, those are aspects of yourself that are only thrown into a pseudo darkness because you're addicted to the light. You are a disciple of the light, the false light. But that light has a particular property which throws all the rest of your consciousness, you see, into darkness.
Michael, I want to take a little break here at this point, begin to round things up with the first hour, and then continue talking more with you in our members section. But is there anything more you want to mention here in the last couple of minutes in regards to what you call the positive thinking cult? Or is a few more things maybe we can bring up about that before we round things off for the first hour, Michael?
Only that it was a response. It has to be understood in the context of history. It was a response to this Calvinism and certain aspects of this behaviorism. And it's legitimate to that extent. That people needed to get lightened up, you know, and think more about themselves and their own prosperity and so forth and so on. There's nothing necessarily wrong with that. But the other aspect why I wanted to talk about this is because, do you remember in the show we did last week, part one, we talked about and discussed that it's very important that the face that you show to the unconscious, or we said that it's important to know what kind of face you're showing to the unconscious, because the unconscious is purely reflexive. Whatever face you shine into it, it will reflect back. Remember
yes,
that?
Yes, absolutely. Yep.
Well, maybe we can pick up with that in the second part, because it's a bit longer to explain. But that's what I thought when I listened back to the show, is that I had said something and people could have misinterpreted. When I talked about showing a loving and a strong, a positive face to the unconscious, you know, I didn't mean your Prozac smiling face.
Right.
That's disaster. You're still going to meet demons. And you go, well, I'm very positive. I'm showing a really good face to the unconscious. Oh, my God. Why is it the Dracula is appearing? Well, because I didn't mean, right? I didn't mean, because remember, we have to now, we even have to redefine what we mean by happy, strong, loving, and positive, because those things have been completely co-opted by this evangelical, canned, motivational, Anthony Robbins, pump it till it hurts, go, 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 you know, sort of California, it's all one season world, malarkey, palaver, you know? And if people don't interpret it correctly, they'll be thinking that's the kind of face that you have to show to the unconscious. Well, that's doom. That's not going to work at all.
Okay, well, that's very interesting. Let's talk about some of that, Michael, in our next segment here. But again, please mention your websites for us, Michael, so people know where to go, where to check out more of your work and some of the projects that you're currently involved in.
Okay, they can go straight to michaeltesorian.com. There's all my other websites are listed there, including Architects of Control, which is the DVD you and I did on psychology and conspiracy. It's the first of its kind in the world, so people should look into that. I have my forum there, and the forum on the War on You pages and What's New pages. They're always being updated with some fascinating new information about, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood and lots of other interesting things that are going on in our world. So people are free to go in there and check that out. But you can just go to michaeltesorian.com for that. To check that out. And also, again, emphasize that the links we'll put on this page that we don't have time to go into, these shadowy characters, you know, people need to track that down and find out about these institutes and these sort of philosopher ideologue types. Hugely important there to research it and find out, because again, as the mainstream media are going to start homogenizing this, the only defense against that is having your own thesis, a very strong understanding of the real meat and potatoes of these subjects, so it doesn't get all watered down and diluted.
Absolutely. Links are available on redicecreations.com. The main website is michaeltesorian.com. Go there, check it out, check out his forum, some of the projects and Oracle Origins and Oracle DVD series as well. Stay with us, Michael, and we'll be back more after this break. We talk more with Michael in our second hour. We begin to talk about the face that you turn towards the unconscious will reflect back to you. What's good and what's bad about this? We talk about man as a robot, a product, and the technological man. We discuss how this ties in with the behaviorists and the Calvinists, and how out of these kind of pre-scientific ideas, the con of the Constitution have been possible. Basically, you sign away your freedom. We discuss the free man on the land ideas, legalese, the Declaration, and the Constitution, and the importance of disconnection and detachment as opposed to physically fighting the New World Order. We round things up talking about the death instinct. So don't miss our second hour with Michael for our members.